Hello and welcome to Jim Brown's Outrigged Capercast. I'm Jim, and this is my ongoing collection of stories about modern seafaring watercraft and their people. Now, I admit that since last time I've sort of lost track of where we are, but I don't know what to do with Christy. Geez, she has really been an ice maiden.
Did you ever wonder how I got this way, Tiger? You had this caper marked number 4, but it's actually number 8. And you say it's more anchoring stories. Geez, do we get to go somewhere?
Well, sure, Christy. Seafaring often involves anchoring wherever you go. I'm just trying to spin a few capers here that'll indicate just how tenuous and how varied anchoring can be. And probably there are more boats lost from their anchorages than from hurricanes or collisions or shipwrecks. So sometimes you can really learn some seamanship from listening to anchoring stories. Here's a little anchoring story from which we can probably learn nothing. It occurred again in Scrimshaw, but back in the early 1970s. My wife Joanna and I and our two boys had cruised down from California along the western seaboard of Mexico, and we had anchored in a wonderful little bay there called Tenacatita. I think now it's overwhelmed with a giant resort. But we anchored and discovered that there was a lot going on around the boat. That particular bay seems to be used by the manta rays for their yearly get-togethers, and they were really performing wonderful loops. They'd come up to the surface on their backs and then roll back down and chase each other around. The water was kind of cloudy and we couldn't see them too much, but they were really just gorgeous when they came close to the surface. And we were quite enthralled with the whole thing, especially when considering that the logo for my Sea Runner trimarans, our sail emblem, is a stylized manta ray. I've always thought they were the most beautiful creatures in the sea, and I guess there are some places in the Caribbean where they call them sea runners. But anyway, we were having busy days there, and we were tired at night and went to bed early. But I woke up in the middle of the night. It's another one of those cases where, you know, the boat and I are so close that anything strange going on wakes me up. And I lay there for a while. It was very quiet. I couldn't really figure out what was going on. I couldn't hear any sounds from the little town, and I could hear just the very slightest sound, a trickle really, of the boat moving slowly through the water. And I thought for a moment about, you know, tidal current. Maybe, well, not in that little bay. There's no tidal current there. What in the world's going on? So I got up and looked around. And Mexico was gone. I couldn't even see lights ashore. So I climbed around the deck and looked at the anchoring situation. And the anchor was leading out forward, all right, doing apparently what it was supposed to do. But I'll be darned, where it went down to cut the water, I noticed a small wake coming away from the anchor. And I grabbed a hold of it, and I could feel the pulses. I knew now what was going on. A manta ray had become ensnared by our anchor somehow and headed for deep water. These are members of the shark family, and they have to keep moving in order to breathe. They can't pump their gills like the fin fishes. They have to be moving through the water in order to respirate. So the poor thing had decided that the best way for it to stay alive was to keep moving and make us move along with it. There was a manta ray down there dragging us out into the ocean. It was taking us west, but we were wanting to go southeast. But there was this incredible power, you know, the wingspan on those things is up to 8 feet or so, and you can just see the thing down there pumping away and dragging us for Japan. Well, the boys must have heard me huffing and puffing up there, so they got up, and I was trying to explain to them what was going on, and Joanna got up, and we were all out there trying to figure out what to do now. How do we get clear of this critter? Well, when you catch a fish, The surest way to lose it, I guess, is to let slack in the line. So we got all of our extra anchor line together, tied it end for end, made a huge ball of extra line on deck, and then uncleated the portion that was leading to the poor manta ray and dumped the whole pile overboard. And just let slack, let the situation resolve itself. After a while, we stopped moving, so we pulled in all the line and got the anchor up, and it was, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was no sense in trying to go back to bed. We just set sail in a light breeze and headed back for Mexico. Now, I don't know of another situation where one would use that tactic. If you had the anchor lodged in rock or in coral, or for any reason you couldn't get the anchor up, I don't think that throwing a lot of slack at it would help, because if the slack was sinking line, if it, like most anchor rode is nylon and it sinks, and so if it were to pile up on the bottom, you just might get it caught up in other stuff. So I don't know another situation where one would use that tactic of throwing a lot of slack at an anchor. We sure felt badly for the manta ray. You know, when we got the anchor up, it had chunks of meat and slime all over it. You know, felt badly for being anchored in their love nest. It goes back to the Robinson Jeffers concept of not man apart. There is no way that we can separate ourselves from the natural environment. And sometimes it seems like Jeffers was right. You know, any amount of human activity at all is, as he said, infinitely too much. But nature allows us. It even allows us to anchor. And there's a lot of judgment when it comes to deciding when and where to anchor. So maybe we can learn something from this caper after all. You know, if in any situation we happen into a place where there's a lot of wildlife going on, particularly at breeding time, you know, maybe it's our place to just close the bedroom door and slip away. You know, tie up to a dock and tell another sea story.
Hey, you promised them a shipwreck in here someplace, but you've only got 12 minutes left.
There she goes again, GMT, the great mother of time. But we're going back to the late 60s now to tell about the loss of the good ship Lono Kai, cruising bird. She was a 38-foot trimaran built to the plans for the first multi-hull I ever designed, and built by my late great friend Mark Hassel, who was perhaps the most illustrious of all my design clients. He built three of my boats, one of which he lost in a shipwreck, and the other two he sailed around the world. I'll probably be telling tales about this guy all through the Capercast series. So, of course, he was one of the first to buy plans from me, and I was amazed at how quickly he built the boat. I think it only took him like 9 months down there near Santa Barbara, California. And I was able to go down for the launching, quite proud of the boat as he was too. The thing seemed to sail just fine. And Mark had big plans for the boat. Not long after the launching, which is another caper for another cast, he bumped into a wonderful young woman named Bonnie, and the two of them hit it off. Mark invited her to go for a cruise with him out to Anacapa Island for a long weekend. It was midwinter, not an ideal time for a cruise, so they took a friend with them, a guy I never met, and they had a hard, fast reach across the Santa Barbara Channel, about 40 miles to Anacapa Island, went around to the west side of the island and into a tight cove that Mark knew well, where they were pretty well sheltered from this hard blow. Now, Mark did a prudent thing. He put out two anchors with the boat set in at the apex of a V between them, which is a really good idea when anchoring in iffy conditions, because no matter which way the wind blows, you're not going to have to completely turn over either one of these anchors. And they spent the night there, bouncing a bit, but did well until along about before sunrise, when the wind changed and came blowing right into their supposedly well-sheltered little cove. Well, the wind picked up, but both anchors were holding. To give them a better chance to hold, Mark did another prudent thing. He let out more scope, that is, more length of line, so that the pull on the anchors was more parallel with the bottom, not trying to pull the anchors up. But the additional scope allowed the boat to back into the cove to the point where his stern was very close to the rocks. Anacapa, all those Channel Islands are very high, rocky islands, steep, rocks all around. Well, the boat was leaping around like a gazelle. They tried to fix some breakfast. Bonnie said it was like trying to cook in a train wreck. And what's more, she was new to this. She was not a sailor. This was her first cruise. And as the morning progressed, of course, Mark became more and more worried about the anchors holding. Would the anchors themselves continue to bite the bottom? Would the short length of chain on the anchors prevent the anchor line from chafing on rocks on the bottom? And would the line hold? He said that he noticed that when the seas, which were now breaking over the bow of the boat, when the seas hurled the vessel backwards, the anchor line stretched out to the point where they looked to be, you know, more or less half of their original diameter. So as the morning rolled on, Mark became more and more concerned, and he decided to start the engine to try to take some of the load off of the anchor tackle. So the boat had a small inboard engine, and he started running the engine and realized that the engine was not running properly. It was not putting out power, barely enough power, to drive the boat ahead enough to make one of the anchor lines go slightly slack. But it was certainly not enough power to motor out of that cove. Well, things were starting to add up on Mark now, and that's what happens during crisis situations. It's not just one predicament, it's several that seem to really bear down on the decision-making power of the skipper. And the way things were going, he concluded that they were going to have to get out of there. And that meant they were going to have to sail out of there. Now, Mark knew what he was doing. He was an experienced sailor. He had owned a small trimaran before, and he knew that if he could take off from the anchorage on the port tack, that he had room to get out of this cove. So, with the help of the engine, they were able to get one of the anchors up, and the other one was still holding. Now, the boat is rigged as a catch, two masts, so they got the mizzen up, reefed, got the mainsail up, reefed, and got a small jib ready to go. Now, in order to ensure that he could leave the cove on the port tack, he decided to sacrifice the anchor, that is, cut the line and leave it. By now, there were occasional waves breaking over the bow, and the boat was sawing violently left to right on the single remaining anchor. And Mark told me later, he said, "Jimmy, there was no other way to be sure that when we came free of that anchor, we would be on the port tack so I could drive out of that cove under sail." So Mark got their biggest knife out of the galley, gave it to Mike, and said, "When I holler cut, you have to cut that anchor line right now." So they got the jib up. Of course, all the sails were flogging madly. And as the boat began to yaw off to starboard, Mark sheeted in the main and mizzen. The boat began to range ahead. He sheeted in the jib and hollered, "Cut!" And the boat began to drive over the anchor. Mike was up on the bow, sawing away on that anchor line. He got through two of the three strands just as the boat sailed beyond the anchor to the point where the one remaining strand jerked the bow around onto the starboard tack, and the boat went sailing right onto the rocks in a crashing surf.
"No, Jimmy. You cannot just leave us there. Never mind the boat. What happened to those poor people?"
Okay, Christy. that was about the first boat built to my design, and to have Mark lose it like that, well, it was a great blow to my psyche, but imagine what it did to his. Well, I'll tell you what it did to his. They clung to that boat and rowed it right up onto the rocks. Nobody was thrown into the water. They watched and listened as the rocks literally ground the bottom out of all three hulls. And when it was over, and when the storm was over, they found themselves about 12 feet above the high tide line. It was so different than a monohull shipwreck, where the ballast keel would have stopped the boat long before it got out of the surf, rolled it on its side, and the people would have been thrown into the water and had to contend with swimming ashore and climbing out on the rocks in a crashing surf. Now, in those days, Anacapa Island was essentially uninhabited. It's a very mountainous desert island. And in this cove, the storm seas had carved a shallow cave out of the face of a cliff, not far from where the boat went ashore. So Mark and Bonnie and Mike moved the stuff off of the boat that allowed them to live in this cave for almost a week. They had food and water on board, and Mark had recently purchased a 12-volt television set, and he was able to extract the battery from the boat and set up in the cave so that they could even watch television. But they had plenty to do. They had food and water, and Mark figured that he could strip most of the hardware and fittings off of the boat while they had time waiting for rescue. They had no communication, but they piled up everything useful in the cave, hoping that somebody, a fishing boat or a yacht, would come along. Well, it was midwinter, but eventually a lobster boat came poking into the cove to set some traps, and they were able to hail the operator and say, "Hey, we're shipwrecked, rescue us." And they arranged with the fishermen to take them and all of this gear they had collected back to the mainland. Now, Mark and Bonnie apparently had quite a conversation on the way back. Bonnie's first cruise, shipwrecked for a week on a desert island. They're going home to nothing. That is, Bonnie explained, "Hey, you know, between us, we're about $4,000 in debt, Mark. I owe about $2,000 on my Volkswagen. You owe about $2,000 on the boat. I have an apartment with a garage. We can put all this stuff in the garage, and we're going to have to go to work so that we can build another boat and sail around the world." Now, please believe me, folks, I am not making this up. That is exactly what they did. But what can be learned from this caper about anchoring? Well, hindsight is easy, of course, but maybe the first thing would be that if you have two anchors down and they are holding, depending on the circumstances, it might be a good idea to just try to ride it out. Another bit of hindsight is, keep a good sharp knife on board. Mark later explained that he said, "You know, we're vegetarians, so we don't really have a good sharp knife in the galley." Another little nugget is that if you're going to cast an anchor loose, you don't need to do it with a knife. You can take all the anchor line that's behind the mooring bit, the cleat on the bow where the anchor is made fast. All the other line can be made into a tight ball, bundled up, and you can put a float on it and get it ready to throw. So when the time comes, you simply cast it off, throw the line overboard, let the float mark the spot, and then when the storm clears, maybe you or somebody else can come back and pick it up. And of course, the big lesson is that if you're going to go cruising in the wintertime, you'd better choose an anchorage that's pretty well protected on all sides. Well, the great mother of time is going to run us out of here, so we'll have to come back to this subject again, and I hope you'll be on board when we do. Fair winds.